Hello, this is Hillel Tecton, and this is the third podcast. The subject is going to be the contemporary situation and the failure of the market, and the way the failure of the market has led to a series of unforeseen consequences. In particular, at the moment, what we're seeing is a downturn and, in fact, a depression, with results which were, of course, predictable, that's to say, declining standard of living and an elongation or a greater extension of inequality in the society. That's the overall background, declining standard of living, increasing inequality. That had been occurring before the downturn, and it's become worse. And this has led to a series of demonstrations, strikes, riots over the world. We've had whatever one called it, a riot or a form of demonstration in Britain where looting took place. We've had various forms existing in other countries, more organized forms, as in the Arab countries. But we've also had the more important demonstrations and strikes occurring in a number of countries. In particular, in the last 6 months, we're talking about demonstrations, strikes occurring in South Africa, we're on the mines, and in wider aspects of the economy, including agriculture. And very recently, we now have mass demonstrations, almost of a new kind, which occurred in Brazil. It's interesting to take the two examples of South Africa and Brazil, because they are, in fact, crucial in understanding what is happening and crucial in probably acting as a catalyst for change within an understanding of what is happening. Now, the failure of the market, of course, rests in the downturn, in the depression. The fact is that we remain in this depression that began in 2007, and although we've had ups and downs, it's been mostly down. And for the majority of the population in the world, it has been a troublesome time, and for some, an absolute disaster. In the case of South Africa, we're talking of platinum mines, where the strikes began, where the workers were paid not much more than what they had been paid, taking account of inflation, when the new African government came in, illustrating very clearly the nature of capitalism and the fact that the issue was capitalism and not simply race, although racial discrimination was critical to the previous regime. Nonetheless, the fact is that even after the abolition of the various forms of discrimination, the lot of the ordinary worker has not changed very much. So, the point here is that the market has not worked, the IMF prescriptions for South Africa have not worked, the discontent in South Africa is rising and rising. South African government really hasn't proposed very much in response. The fact is that in South Africa we have one of the most unequal societies in the world, and there's no proposals to change that. It's not just on the mines, of course, it's throughout the economy. The interesting thing about it has been the way the workers effectively separated themselves off from Gesatu, the union which was controlled by the Communist Party. And of course, the interesting thing about South Africa is the way there is a government which amounts to a coalition between Communist Party and Nationalists. In fact, the Communist Party is an integral part of the African National Congress and was crucial in its reconstruction in the 1950s. So what we are talking about is workers separating themselves off from what claimed to be a left-wing government, but in fact was a government or is a government which is maintaining the market in its pristine state in close collaboration with the IMF. But today, workers are now striking throughout the economy. So things are changing. We have to ask why. Why is this occurring? It's occurring in part because of the downturn itself, because the sale of minerals, the sale of metals, has gone down at least in price, and consequently it reflects a change in total sales. So the market has precipitated something which was going to happen anyway, that's to say the formation of a union independent of a government which claims to be left-wing but is in fact right-wing, and very much part of the Stalinist culture which existed at one time, but remains in particular parts of the world. If we turn to Brazil, the situation is somewhat different, but we also have a situation where a government which claims to be left-wing. But nonetheless, given the downturn, the rapid growth which had existed has come to an end in Brazil. Growth was only about 1.5% in the last past period. The consequence is, of course, that the government cannot fulfill its promises. And indeed, the way in which any government can fulfill promises within capitalism in order to raise standard of living is always under question. In particular, of course, we had these demands for a better health service, better education, something which one would expect any left-wing government to undertake, which evidently the present government in Brazil did not go sufficiently far. Well, the market does not support public enterprise, the public sector. And health and education are needs-based sectors, not market-type sectors. And in fact, health and education do not flourish in private enterprise, whatever the arguments, self-serving arguments that have been produced. Now, what has also been occurring throughout the world is an increasing proletarianization of the so-called middle class, which, in a sense, has never been middle class and has never been a separate class. The majority, the vast majority of people in that category are white-collar workers. Some are routine white-collar workers, very similar, as it were, to the lower levels of manual workers. And a considerable number are highly skilled white-collar workers. Nonetheless, they are white-collar workers. They are workers. They sell their labor power to employers. They are dependent on the employer for work, and the employer can dismiss them. What has been occurring is an increasing proletarianization of this category. Up to a point, there had been a certain ambiguity. Sometimes they had guaranteed employment. Sometimes there was a patriarchal form of control or whatever. Today there's an increasing proletarianization of this group, both in terms of their conditions of work and in their pay. That's to say, instead of having a relatively relaxed attitude to the conditions of work, today white-collar workers are expected to work from 9 to 5, let's say fixed hours, with fixed holidays, fixed times of going here or there. And they are subject to regular checks, as in a factory. And secondly, their pay, effectively, has changed in that, whereas formerly, in earlier times, their pay was relatively high in relation to manual workers, today they are considerably changed and can indeed be lower than that of skilled manual workers. Consequently, we have this increasing proletarianization of the white-collar group. Students, majority of students, enter this group, and this is their future. So it's not surprising that students, if they look at their careers, should themselves be worried and want to act quite independently of other changes. However, when it's combined with a real change in the overall capitalist economy, where indeed the possibilities of employment are reduced, so that not only are they employed under conditions which are not easy, and their pay is poor, but the prospects of even getting that job are reduced, it's not surprising that they would act, or consider acting. So we have to see it in this context, not just in Brazil, but everywhere. Turkey. There is another aspect, of course, and that is that irrespective of the proletarianization, there is the fact that young people who are not yet subject to controls at work have not experienced the forced adaptation, the discipline of work, and the punishments of work, and who have not become either cynical or despairing, as many older people are forced to become. It's also the case then that young people who have not been through these experiences do not feel the same need to kowtow to authority. And consequently, when observing the harshness of the climate, of the market climate, feel that they have to act. Their parents basically agree with them, but are afraid to do anything. That is the usual case. Not always the case, but it is common. So one expects students to stand up, as it were, for the world. To stand for a better future. To stand for the future which their parents, in fact, want, but cannot act to obtain. And historically, this has been the case. There's, of course, the very well-known example of the Rodniki, the students who went to the peasantry. They did not understand the situation, of course, and the peasantry did not accept it. However, the fact is that a very large percentage of students actually sympathized with the oppressed and went to help them. This is in Russia in the 1860s, 1870s. It wasn't as if it was a few students, it was a very large percentage of students who did that. From that time onwards, we may say the precedent had been set. In 1968, of course, we have, in the memory of most people, we have the example of the students, young people who acted in Paris, and not just in Paris, of course, but mainly in Paris. So, we may expect not just the changes which have been taking place, the demonstrations, the riots from Britain, Sweden, across the world, through the Arab countries. But further action, and ultimately we can expect the whole population to begin to act. The parents with the youth as well. So, let me just turn to a number of these countries themselves. It has been fashionable to talk of the BRICS, to which I referred, Britain, Russia, India, China, South Africa, as countries which would save the world, that somehow the ruling class in these countries was going to lift the economy so that the standard of living of all would be a lot higher, growth would be considerable, and the world would be a better place. There never was a hope that that would happen. It is amazing that anybody bought the idea. But it wasn't just propaganda. The fact is, if one reads the Financial Times and other newspapers, that it was believed that China would pull the world out of the depression. It was believed that India would join China and that Russia would be part of this. South Africa was sometimes put in this group and sometimes not. But it never made any sense. In the case of Russia, of course, you have a crippled economy. An economy in which there's capital flight from Russia today, which there has been in the past, in which, in effect, Russia is exporting capital rather than importing it. At various periods, some of it has come back. What is really sad is to see how much of a rust belt Russia has become. Whereas it had an industry, however uncompetitive on the world market, it had an industry which could supply up to a point the needs of the population. It's true, at low, relatively low levels, quality was low. Nonetheless, it could do so. This industry has been allowed to fall into disuse. There is an arms industry, and there are limited aspects of this industry existing, but they have not reinvested. They have not built it up. They have not tried to make it competitive. or alternatively, they have not tried to protect the industry and try and build it up in order to be part of the world market, or keep it protected in order to raise the standard of living of the ordinary population, or at least protect it. Under these conditions, what you have in Russia is not an economy which is growing in the real sense, but an economy which is supplying much of the world with minerals, timber, furs, oil, diamonds, and gold. Raw materials, but a very limited industry outside the military industry. There is no hope whatsoever of Russia being part of and developing an emerging economic lifeline. If anything, it'll help to pull the world down. This is a reflection of the fact that the shift from a Stalinist economic system to capitalism is still in progress and is doubtful that it'll ever be made. What we have is a partial shift, a limited shift, that's as far as you can say. It remains in an aborted state, or a limited state, or if you want to call it something, you could call it a particular kind of capitalism, or you can call it a disintegrating Stalinism. In other words, the market failed. It failed and has failed and did fail in Russia. Apart from the production of a series of oligarchs who own many of these minerals, oil and gas, etc., it did little else. In the case of China, this situation is different, and there's no question but the Chinese system did grow. But the growth itself had to reach some kind of peak, and it has done so. Just as in the Soviet Union, there was a relatively high rate of growth for a period of time, which then eventually, by the mid-70s and certainly in the 80s, had gone right down. So in China we find that once they had absorbed the labor that they could, once labor became more skilled, once the factories required higher skills, the growth would necessarily decline. That's to say, because it was no longer possible to direct workers very easily from one point to another. It was no longer possible either to exploit workers to the degree to which they were before, in terms of hours of work, conditions of work, or for that matter, in terms of pay. Consequently, the growth rate is declining. It's still a high growth rate, relatively, but it's a lot less than it was. Now, this is an inevitable result, which could have been predicted right from the beginning. The beginning of the industrialization period. What has made it, of course, worse is that the downturn has meant that the export-driven industrialization or growth in China has become somewhat less, precisely because of the overall depression. So in other words, the market malfunction has limited the growth in China. the actual success in China is to a considerable extent due to the fact that the state itself could direct what the economy and could provide the necessary incentives. Some people argue indeed that the Chinese growth rate had a lot to do with the subsidies provided by the center, that's to say providing land, utilities and so forth at relatively low rates or in fact free. At any rate, it makes no difference. The fact is that there was no possibility of China pulling the world out of the overall depression or leading the world to the promised land. It's not the fault of China, as it were, but the fact that the market in itself cannot do it. That is a necessary result. The fact that in China, in order to maintain the surplus that they had, in order to expand, that they had to invest in motorways, freeways, and towns which were not occupied. That's to say, the motorways had few cars, if any, and a number of towns had very few occupants. The fact they had to do that, they'd go for this overinvestment in infrastructure, is an indication of failure, of course. Well, one doesn't have to go any further. The fact is that in India there wasn't any hope that it would ever be able to do it, given the overall poverty in that country. I've already mentioned South Africa. One can, of course, point out that at the present time, it is unlikely not just the market be able to save the world. It's clearly not doing that. But that the various Stalinist remnants, as in the Communist Party of China or the Communist Party of South Africa, and the social democratic forms to the extent they exist in Brazil, cannot do the job either. That seems very clear. So, we have to conclude on a more optimistic note. And that is that it does look, with the growth of these movements, with a spontaneous eruption of young people into the streets in order to demand change, that we can begin to hear in the distance, it's true in the far distance, but nonetheless in the distance, the drumbeat of revolution. It is there. The youth are beginning the process. It may take some time, and we may not all be around by the time the march reaches where we are today. But it is definitely there. The despair which some people held at a time that, in fact, there'd be no hope for change, no hope for socialism, is no longer justified. We can see changes in the air. Nor should we think that the fact that these spontaneous movements have occurred, and we know that they cannot go very far because they precisely are spontaneous and they're not directed and there is no party or parties involved. Nor should we think, because of that there'll be no change. It's true that in the case of the Arab countries, the situation hasn't altered. However, these are the beginnings. And even in those countries, we can expect that the attempt to hold back history will not last that long. The backwardness of religion cannot last as a means of holding back people. Now, in the case of countries like South Africa and Brazil, and developed countries for that matter, we can expect now that the authorities have taken note, and they will have to decide between repression and concession. They are clearly worried, and some are no doubt frightened. We don't know which way are they going to go yet. But so far, they have not retreated far. However, they know this process will not stop. And it's not possible, in fact, to hold back the whole population forever. If they do take a route of repression, the result will be the worse for them. We know that. We know that from history. So, we can expect that change will come. We can expect the movements to gradually evolve. The future parties will be very different from what exists today. Part of the hope which exists, given by, in particular, the demands in Brazil, are that the demands will be for control from below, which, after all, is the demand of socialism. Control from below. And that is what they are calling for, direct democracy, which stands in total contrast with the authoritarian forms which lie behind the formal democracy which exists in many countries. Thank you. Okay.